Welcome to Podcasting Tech, a podcast for busy entrepreneurs who want professional sound and appearance for their content creation. I'm Matthew Passi, your host, and a 15-year veteran in the podcasting industry. In this show, we interview podcasters and content creators to learn about the technology they use to make their shows sound and look amazing. We also connect with the people who develop software solutions to highlight the latest and simply greatest tools out there to help you be successful. Head on over to podcastingtech.com, where you can subscribe to the show on YouTube or your favorite podcasting platform, and join us on this exciting journey to unlock the full potential of your podcast.
This is the last one in the Something in Media series. I hope you've enjoyed series one. If you want series two and you find these interesting, please let me know. Drop us an email, podcasts@wearestable.com. Be good to hear from you. Welcome to Something in Media, a show that tells the story of successful people in the general world of media and what it takes to make it to the very top. I'm Dave Maguire. In this episode, we welcome along the one and only Des Kelly, chief reporter and interviewer for BT Sport.
Gary Lineker picked it up and made it work because he could have just been eating his sandwich while I'm doing the interviews, and suddenly I throw back to him, no, and he picked it up perfectly. It was great. And if those two had messed it up, I would have looked terrible.
Award-winning columnist, national newspaper editor, radio presenter, TV presenter, it's fair to say that Des has had one hell of a career. As we'll hear, Des's stellar career in the media wasn't a given. Growing up in South London, he originally thought he'd become a teacher. But after an introduction to a local newspaper when at university, Des soon realised that journalism was his true calling in life. Des's career has gone from strength to strength, and he freely admits that he never really had a plan. He's just said yes to all the opportunities that have excited him. Today, Des is recognised as one of the country's preeminent sports reporters. And we started off by speaking about Des's philosophies to interviews.
It's the way I would approach it. If I'm talking to somebody, I try to have a conversation with them as opposed to quizzing them. It's not Frost Nixon. It's a football match. You can get into an argument, but there are all sorts of different ways of doing it. I think the way to do it that suits me is to have a conversation, because there's nothing better on TV, particularly in a sterile environment such as that, sort of in front of the boards, post-match interview sort of feel. It's very, very narrow parameters you can sort of work within. And if you can get a laugh and have a joke or just go something a bit random, I like anything that goes somewhere else. Jack Grealish this weekend, I'll give you an example. So he's had a great game. He comes in after the match. We want to do him on the pitch, but City do not want him on the pitch, which was a bit of a shame because I think you capture more atmosphere. Anyway, Jack comes in, chatting away, and I'm three questions through, and he's buzzing. He's great chat. He's great fun. He's a nice lad. Manchester City media team and part of the coaching staff are trying to drag him out. So I'm thinking, oh, we'll keep going for as long as we can, and they're Guardiola likes them all to go into the dressing room afterwards and come back out. So we're doing a quick one. But Jack got out of it nicely. He said, I've got to go now because I've got to find out how many days I've got off now. He wanted to tell. And it's a way he kind of got himself out of a situation to help me as well. You can, those kind of moments make it a little bit more real. You can have a proper chat with somebody. You don't have to poke the bear all the time, you know.
Is that informality? I don't want to say informality, because it's not really, as you say, it's a technique, but has that always been there with you, or is that something you've learned?
Oh yeah, I've worked for nearly 40 years in the media, so you're kind of not going to change now. And it was part of the question when I started at BT. Well, I didn't start at BT. When I started at BT after many years in newspapers and radio, it was to do a late night sort of American style show, magazine show. After the first year, BT sort of chopped pretty much all the studio programs and went into live rights. So they asked me to do the interviewing, the reporting job. And I said this, I'd like to do it if I can do it this way. Because I see it, I understand other channels have different ways of doing it. They ask very short, quick questions. And it's always a question. And I used to get people sending old hacks from bygone days, say, you're not asking a question. And sometimes I'm absolutely not. I'm reinforcing something he said or saying something that I believed from the game, and then I don't have to challenge them. Then you have a chat, and that's always been that way. sometimes it goes wrong, but not very often. And after a number of years doing the job, you kind of get to know these people. And I know that Pep Guardiola is going to be really short pre-match. There's no point keeping him there for long because he doesn't really like doing it. It's something that knocks his focus. Jurgen will chat all the way through the day, right up to 1 hour before kickoff. Then he wants to get out of there quite quickly. He's got other things to do. So you kind of know the people. And after a time, before I was doing the TV, I was obviously involved in sport, involved in newspapers, and so I knew a lot of the people anyway. It helps sometimes because you don't feel like they're going to ambush them, you know what I mean? That sort of thing, so you can have a conversation.
But let's go back to where it all started for you. I believe you grew up in South London, in my research shows
Mitcham.
Mitcham. I got Wimbledon. Is that close?
Oh, I went to school in Wimbledon. That was because it was Irish Catholic family, and that was the nearest Catholic school. So no, I wasn't in the posh bit. I was in Mitcham. No offence to anyone who's still in Mitcham, but I don't miss you.
Good memories growing up in terms of your household, mum, dad.
My dad was a foreman in a plastics factory. My mum worked in a sweets factory as well, and then she was a nurse in the Mayday Hospital. So yeah, it was how can I put it? I had no idea what I was going to do. I thought I'd probably drift into teaching, but I really wanted to be in a band. I mean, I took a year out to play in bands and things like that. It was all good fun.
What age were you when you did that?
Oh, that's after sixth form. So I did my sixth form in A-levels and then took a year off to try and become a rock star. I didn't really try that hard. But the problem was I didn't really know what I was going to do. Yeah. So I ended up thinking I was going to be a teacher, which would have been a catastrophe because I'm the most impatient man in the world. So I thought, so luckily things changed.
And so you had obviously a creative spark then at school.
I thought I did, yeah.
Well, you obviously did with music and, you know, looking around to see the guitar and there was music when we were playing when you came in. So it's still there. But was sport also a part of that?
Yeah, loved playing football. Wasn't great at it, but very competitive. It wasn't sport that got me into covering BT Sport. It was, how can I put this in a very short way? I don't have any family in the media, right? The easiest way, everyone says, how do you get into the media? The easiest way to get into the media is to have a parent or two, and nepotism rules. It works perfectly. And those people get a foot in the door and they get a chance to then stay. But people like me don't get those opportunities because we're an Irish immigrant family and we don't get the Jessicas and Gileses of the world don't get the little red carpet treatment. They jump the queue for work placements, that kind of thing. So what happened to me was a friend of mine who, again, wasn't particularly connected. He was working on the Richmond and Twickenham Times Group in West London, which was owned by David Dimbleby. So he was... That family is royalty in media terms, particularly in that era. And he managed to get this placement there. And he'd failed his degree a year early. So he was working, and my mate was working, and I was still doing my degree. So I filled in for him when he was on holiday, and they offered me a job.
What kind of job? What kind of work were you
doing? It was a proper, I mean proper, very proper, old fonts, everything else, broadsheet newspaper, which categorised and detailed everything that happened in the area. Every court case, everything. It was a paper of record for the west of London. It was very impressive for its time and its workforce, and the people who worked there all moved through it. And he offered me, him and Malcolm Richards, offered me a job for immediately, and I said no. And what they did, which was pretty special, was... they said, we'll hold a job for you, and when you finish your degree, which was great, but it was a disaster for my last year at uni. It was just like, okay, I've got a free pass. So I went in there, and I was doing news, and then Alex Spink is still in journalism. He's a great lad. He was doing the sport, I was doing the news, and within a few months, redesigning the paper, running. It was great. Yeah. It was an amazing reading ground.
So did you have any formal training, or was it just literally training
on
the job?
I was doing English, and that was my... Yeah. There was no media studies. Yeah. There was no teaching you how to do it other than getting absolutely rocked when you do something bad on the newspaper. Yeah. My first gig was the borough's biggest sunflower, and then genuinely was. And then the second was a horrible house fire. You had to turn up and go in and interview everybody. It was great. It was all new to me, and I knew exactly from that moment I really want to do this.
Yeah. So how long were you there for?
Not long enough, because they all got very upset because you change people and change the newspaper and then you disappear somewhere else. I don't know, couple of years, probably two and a half. I couldn't afford to stay there any longer because you didn't get paid much. So I went to Hayter Sports Agency in Fleet Street, and that was a sports specialist place. And everyone's been through that. That is the motherlode for a load of people. Mark Samuel's there. I mean, I could give you a long list, all the way back to people like Richard Keys. You know,
right.
And so Jerry Cox still runs it.
What is that? Is it an agency?
So for instance, there are FA Cup final third round. How many staffers do you have? We had a lot more back then, obviously. Mm-hmm. But no, they just farm out stuff to agencies, local state agencies. Yeah. They still exist, but the digital age has taken away a lot of it. For instance, I would be doing an FA Cup third round. We were really bored here. So it would be Brentford against Fulham, which is a nice little game back then. Now it's obviously a slightly bigger game. But you would have 12 orders to file to 12 newspapers.
Wow.
So you had to work very quickly and process it. It's almost impossible. And you had to phone the copy in.
You're not talking about the same article for 12 different papers. You're talking about different...
Yes.
Differently written.
What we used to do is split it into three, which is you'd have the tabs, then you have the middle market, and then the poshies. But so it set challenges for you. And you got thrown in at the deep end.
Yeah.
And if you... And this is what I would say to anybody who's listening to this. If you get a chance, grab hold of it. And really do. Because it won't come again, necessarily.
How old were you roughly about then?
21.
And you were
Hang on, sorry, let me think. No, yeah, that's about right, about 2021,
And assuming you were saying yes to everything, because had you moved out of home at this point? And
yes, I was living in a flat in Wimbledon by then, little place. But it was a very competitive room, you know what I mean? Everyone wanted a job on the newspaper, and it kept everybody on their toes. And everybody I worked with pretty much has moved on to other places. Some of them are running websites. Some of them are working on newspapers. Some of them are on the radio. So it was a competitive little place.
Yeah. How long were you going through the agency?
So Pete, in that room, next to me was Mark DeMuth, who is now the head of ITB Sport. Peter Drury was the commentator. God love him. We used to hammer him. We used to make him do the cricket because none of us wanted to do the cricket. He's ended up being a great football commentator.
Yeah, yeah.
Alex Bink was there. He does the Daily Mirror. So and some of them went into the stats sort of departments. They became some, those anorex that really drive a commentary.
It's still a competitive process now, but I can imagine because there are less outlets back then, especially for well-paid jobs, it was probably even more competitive and people were trying to... Was it friendly or was it just...
Friendly. Yeah, absolutely was. Absolutely. You're a little team. Yeah. I mean, we laughed at each other's failures and and mistakes, but the golden ticket for Hayter's, you see, was they had good relations with all the newspapers and they would byline you. So that was literally your name up in lights at that age particularly. And also you got known. So I'd ring the Daily Mirror, something crazy had gone on at Crystal Palace, and they'd ordered six paragraphs, for instance, and it's a massive brawl and everything. I ring, I talk to a guy called Bob Blair, who was still there when I went to the Mirror later, and I said, I'll give you 22 pars, byline. He went, deal. So
great.
Next day, you've got the back page lead. And
wow.
So that was the kind of environment. It was very competitive, but... Good. It was a good competitive.
Yeah, and were you kind of commuting all over the country and all over Europe, perhaps, just following British teams?
Yeah, well, I got, because I was a little kid, I got Norwich.
Okay.
And everyone thought that wasn't going to be interesting. Of course, they went to beat Bayern, went on to Inter Milan.
So this is mid-90s, am I right? Yeah. Something like that? Yeah, if my memory serves me right.
Yeah, Chris Sutton was in the team. Yeah. I remember Chris there. So it was great. But again, all fantastic. Sometimes you mucked it up and the office would help you out. But no, as a general rule, you take and grasp that opportunity.
How long were you at Hayter's for?
I went to the Express Group. It was a much bigger and better paper back then, and I ended up being a sports editor, so it went okay. And then originally it was the Sunday Express, and they gave me a column as well, which was a bit of a shock, and that makes you think about things a little bit more. And then they merged the newspapers, Sunday and the Daily Express. That was the start of that kind of stuff going on. I mean, Sunday, working for a Sunday Express was great fun.
And is this still sport?
Yeah. It was at the test. It was then. Delivering one newspaper a week was just the easiest thing in the world. As long as you had something good at the end of the week, it was okay.
I often think about that because, for people who work at the Daily edition, like the Times versus the Sunday Times, and the same with the Express, you might think you got the tougher option, right?
It's all changed now. Back then, yes, completely right. Mm-hmm. Because the first port of call for a breaking news was either television news or the front page of a newspaper popping up at whatever time of night. Now it's 24 hours. There's no point. Every line is blurred. There's a pretense about the Sunday Times being different, but it won't be different. They just mix a few different columnists and faces. It's all becomes the same operation. And you could go missing. I mean, you could literally go missing for a while and then pop up. You can't now because this was early for mobile phones. It's a 24-hour rolling industry all the time. Mm-hmm. It's devalued some of the big things, like the big breaking story doesn't happen. Doesn't really happen in newspaper terms.
No, you're absolutely right. I remember just watching even TV. Newspapers were a focal point of the news. And, even as something, this is going to be so like lowbrow, but like watching The Big Breakfast, and they were doing like the puns from The Sun or The Mirror or something like that. And that was a focal point of the show. Now, newspapers are kind of like, you know, a Sunday morning chat on Sky Sports, you know, when you just the newspapers say this, but people are on Twitter now, aren't they?
Oh, it was war in newspaper terms. Mm-hmm. It was war. The Mirror and The Sun, The Express and The Mail, Today newspaper were in there as well. Oh, I forgot. I went to Today newspaper. I got the chronology wrong.
Well, I was going to say, so you're...
Just, sorry about that.
No, it's all right.
Luckily, it's defunct, so they can't get upset about it.
You went from freelance to...
I went from Haters Sports Agency, which wasn't freelance, but essentially to Today. Sorry, I forgot about that. Which was, again, a really fantastic place to go because it was new and it was fresh and loads of people there were trying to...
How did you find the difference between Haters and then into an institution? Or maybe Today wasn't.
Today was brand new and kind of fresh and a bit experimental. So, no, it was perfect. It was a good place to learn. A lot of good people there as well. Some of them are famous. I won't name check them, but yeah.
Yeah. But so, like, then you went from there and then you obviously built... Your reputation is growing then. Your CV is being built upon. And then the Express is... was it Today a national paper?
It's the first colour newspaper.
Was it really?
Yeah. And Eddie Shah, and then the Murdochs bought it and closed it. But I'd left by then because I'd seen the axe on the horizon. That was only because of, I think it was about printing. And then basically that made the Daily... Oh, if you want to get really weird about it. What happened is that they by closing Today newspaper, they handed the Daily Mail this massive... pool of newspaper buyers. It was just the weirdest thing. Anyway,
yeah. So in your life at that point, let's just go back to when you started at Express, because you talked about that. Were you focused on being a journalist then at that point? Were you like, okay, this is my career. This is exactly what I want to do for the rest of my life in terms of working.
Oh, I'd worked on that a long time ago.
Oh, okay.
As soon as I started at the David Dimbleby's place, I knew this is what I wanted to do.
And writing is something that you...
Writing was what I enjoyed mostly, yeah.
Yeah. And could you foresee, because obviously now you're on TV, you're on radio, you're on a podcast. Obviously you couldn't foresee a podcast, but did you see a varied career at that point? Or were you just like, oh, I'm just going to...
No, I didn't think about it that deeply. And I just grabbed whatever was passing. If it was good, kept doing it. Listen, when I went to Today, I was a reporter and I could write. Then when I went to the Express, they gave me a platform to do columns and things like that, which then helped me move to the Mirror. So again, everything felt like a step up. So I was enjoying it. And writing was what I really loved to do.
Yeah.
And when I was there, I won the Columnist of the Award, and it was good for me. And it gave me sort of a bit more traction with other things. And that helped me move on to the other stuff like Fighting Talk, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, because I'm just like, your Wikipedia is just like a who's who of UK journalistic institutions. But you were...
Sorry, hang on. Yeah. Because when we were used to do Fighting Talk on BBC, people would just go in and vandalise it just for laughs. You know?
So you weren't on the Playboy channel. That's not true.
Yeah. I think there's an NDA somewhere.
Yeah. But what I'm asking is that this may or may not be true, but you were primarily a football/sports writer and then you went to news. Did you go to the Mirror? And then you...
I went to the Mirror as sports editor.
As a sports editor, because you ended up being the editor.
I ended up being what they call acting editor. So because when Matey Boy got fired, I took over. But I was deputy editor I was deputy editor for about 4 or 5 years, and it was okay.
You said Matey Boy, to a bit of context, like this is Piers Morgan, now kind of an infamous media character who's, let's just say, got a certain, quite controversial, but he was fired because he published some doctored photos. Am I right in thinking that? It's like from the Iraq War.
Well, not doctored, they were staged.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, they were staged. Yeah. You were the Mirror and you were an acting editor. What was that like, stepping into that chair? Was it...
Well, if you're deputy editor for a few years beforehand, it's not a massive leap. It just means you've got more of the blame for those following weeks. But it was a weird time anyway, because it was... The newspaper became the story, but not in a good way. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't the happiest time of my life, but lots of amazing experiences. And I would, given the chance, I'd probably think about doing it again, but probably not.
I suppose, like, as a journalist, lots of people are reading what you're writing anyway. You know, you're in the media, people are going to pay attention to what you say. But I have a feeling that role in particular is a certain type of intensity to it, I can imagine. Are you suddenly being asked to be on TV and, you know, you're being interviewed by other newspapers, other TV shows, other radio shows?
Yeah, there's all that. I thought it was a bit like... Lord of the Rings 2. So it starts with a sword fight, ends with a sword fight, but you're in the middle. It never stops. At least Lord of the Rings 1, that's fine. It starts, and at least the other one finishes. You're just stuck in that middle of constant squabble. There's always something going wrong, something going right. Everyone's excited. Everyone's down in the dumps. There's something, some challenge every single day. It was incredibly draining and exciting at the same time, and... Sometimes it was exhilaratingly good and sometimes it was not so good. But I enjoyed it.
How long did that last for?
What?
That role when you were...
A month or two. I mean, we had arguments and things like that, so we left. But I over the 7-8 years I was there, it was a great experience.
That's quite a long time, though, in terms of being at a place like the Mirror.
I did get offered a job when I was... I did get a... Let me rephrase it. I turned down the job because I wasn't happy with... I was going to leave to go to another place, and I didn't fancy the politics of the particular place. Mm-hmm. So I changed tack. Ended up picking up a newspaper column that Ian Wooldridge used to have, OBE. He was a fine writer and he'd been there for all time, and I ended up doing that. So I went back into sport through that and then carried on doing the radio.
Was that Daily Mail?
Yes.
2004?
Yeah.
So that must have been not a leap, but... In terms of the intensity of the job,
it freed me up to do other things that I enjoyed, as opposed to...
Yeah.
And I did enjoy a lot of things in the Mirror, but there were lots of things that were right and wrong with it, but it was great fun. But the change was good for me. It gave me more options to be able to do other things, to go into radio, go into other bits and bobs and things.
Yeah, because tell me, like, your typical day at the Mirror as an acting editor versus, you know, a sports columnist at the Daily Mail.
There wasn't really a typical day, other than that it flaming started early and finished ridiculously late. You'd get the first editions at about 10 o'clock in the evening, and then you would continue to check and change. But... I mean, it's like, listen, it was great. I enjoyed it.
Someone who's quite naive when it comes to the process of making a newspaper, is it literally just seeing an edition and then just saying, I want this there, I want that there, I want this person to write something about this? Well, constantly tweaking?
It needs to be... No, it is. If it's good, it's a more creative process. there's more planning going into it, but you react to events, and the design and the projection and the tone is very important. All of these things come into play. It's not just... Actually, sometimes it feels like that, but more particularly with the broadsheets and the Daily Telegraph can draw a graph at the start of the day, and you know their blocks are going to go in, and you can probably just drop them in. Mm-hmm. But particularly with a paper like the Daily Mirror, it had to have a bit of attitude, a bit of something that wasn't like the Sun.
Yeah,
a little bit of that. And if it's a good newspaper, in a good tabloid newspaper, it has to be a very subjective call. You have to have, and to be fair, we're not great friends, me and Mr. Morgan, but at least, you know, you made a call. You have to be, to drive a newspaper like that, you have to make the call. You can't listen to the 400 people who think you know better. You have to decide, I know better, and this is what we're going to do. And that's the way it is. So the best tabloid newspapers are essentially subjective, or some of the worst as well. Mm-hmm. I could think of a few examples of that. That's for another podcast, maybe.
Oh, yeah, for sure. with that as well, were you writing at that point?
Yeah, I was still doing stuff.
Still doing stuff.
But not much. It's too much going on. It affects your work, so it's easier to clear some of it out of the way so you can focus on the real job.
And did you miss not writing?
Oh, I did miss it, but, you know, you still have to do the job.
Yeah.
So you push the things that get in the way,
yeah,
and you give yourself a bit of time to not have a heart attack at the age of 42.
Well, I suppose it's being a bit like a managing director or a CEO being in the editor.
No, it's much worse. Yeah. CEO and MD, they're characterised, and all they're judged by is the number. Mm-hmm. No, that doesn't happen. You get all of that if you're in charge of a newspaper. It's design, it's staff, it's the... Private Eye will give you six paragraphs about the chief executive of such and such had got a £1 million pay rise while 24 jobs are gone. But you're the guy who's going to have to tell those 24 people to go, and the paper has to be creative and competitive every day. Financial market's fine, but the real market, the tabloid market, is cutthroat, and that's the end. It's much more challenging.
So tell me about, like, obviously with the Mirror, what was your personal situation? Had you moved out of the flat then in
I was living in central London.
Central London.
Yeah, just because it was in and out. I actually lived in Canary Wharf for a little while, but that was sucking the soul out of me.
But then you went to the Daily Mail where you, according to my research / Wikipedia, you stayed for 10 years?
I did a column for 10 years. I didn't have to... They'd give me the odd special to do and things like that, but I was essentially a columnist, but that allowed me to do other things.
So that was one column a week?
One a week, yeah, I think it was. It might have been two for a little while, but it was one a week, and then you do some special stuff, and then the Olympics and blah, 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 the big events, and that was fine. And it was great. It was good. Again, as I said, it opens doors to other things. Yeah. Yeah.
Welcome back. This is Something in Media. I'm Dave McGuire, and we're listening to the story of how Des Kelly became one of the country's best-known sports journalists. Before the break, Des talked about how his career progressed through the ranks of the newspaper world, and now we hear how he transferred his skills into the world of TV. You started inching your way into the world of television, or did that start before...
I did a programme called Inside Sport on BBC One with Gabby Logan and Steve Bunce.
That's what I was getting at, yeah. 2007.
Bunce, yeah, that was great. I got Arsene Wenger's first one-to-one interview. Did a piece for the Champions League final with Petr Cech, and he'd had his head stove in, but so... I got him to bring out his x-rays and everything, which he'd never done before, and he was talking all about it before. So I had a fantastic time there. It was a great, great opportunity. It was a little changer for me. It was nice.
How did that come about then?
I got a phone call.
Oh, really? Did you have an agent at that point, or was it just, just straight direct? And was that...
Well, I was doing BBC Five Live, and, yeah, I can't remember actually the process how I got the job, but it was offered and it worked. I think I went to a pilot. I went to a pilot, and I think there were three or four people who went to a pilot. And
obviously, was that on BT Sport?
No, it was on BBC One.
BBC One.
Yes,
sorry.
It was a 10:30 gig at the Weeb. That was tremendous. I think I had three series out of it, and that was good. And about the same time, I was doing BBC Fighting Talk, and that's an entirely different kind of show, and that gave you different opportunities because you could take the you could take some of the jokes and opinion into broadcast. Mm-hmm. And that was what I loved about Fighting Talk. You could be opinionated. You could try and be funny. Sometimes you weren't. Sometimes you were. Sometimes there was an Ofcom complaint, by the way. it was a sparky show back then. I really enjoyed doing it. And it was... And it's still going. It's still going. It had, how can we put it? It's been muzzled a little bit, but that's just the times we're in. And it's probably quite a sensible thing to do, considering some of the things that we had. I remember getting quite a lot of complaints about one joke that I'm really, really would be unable to repeat now. But it was essential listening, and it was winning Sony Awards. And to have that opportunity to do that kind of... to have that kind of platform gave me chances to do other things. So then I got offered by TalkSport to do a weekly show, and they rang me and said, do you want to do the 6 to 8 on a Sunday? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, you can, we'll leave it to you, right? So there was no one telling me what to say, no one telling me what it had to be called, no one telling me, I could even pick the flaming theme tune.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed that. It was great.
Yeah. So in terms of TalkSport and going into TV, you're like in 40s, something like that.
I must have been younger than that.
Younger. You were definitely younger than that. Let's say 30. But the reason I suppose the reason I asked the previous question was because you get to a certain level of notoriety where people suddenly know your name, they understand you.
Yeah.
And you were doing radio, TV and journalism, written journalism as well. Is that something you started to consciously start to mix up and enjoy?
No, that seems like I've been thinking when really as opposed to doing. What happens was that the TalkSport became difficult when I joined BT because there were so many foreign trips. So when the Champions League kicked in, suddenly I had to fly on the Sunday night instead of the Monday, and that sort of clash happened, and that was all. I enjoyed doing it was great.
Because TalkSport, that was pre News UK acquisition,
yes.
Wasn't it? So did you have a bit more room to...
Probably, but I haven't done the show for them.
No. You're still on occasionally, aren't you?
Like occasionally,
every now and again.
Yeah, well, it's a diary thing. I have been asked to do some stuff, and I do the odd bit. Next season is always... new opportunities, but it is just basically scheduling, I think, because it becomes difficult. I enjoyed TalkSport, and they were good, and it can be competitive, but I like to do a certain type of show, and if it fits in with the pattern of what they're doing now, I think it probably would.
What is that type of show?
Same sort of conversational style, not necessarily chasing headlines or clicks as it is now, isn't it? So I think some of the stuff... it's always been that. It's always been that. So TalkSport has a tabloid base, but there are parts in that schedule that are different, and I like the ones that are different. I like people like Paul Hawksby, who's just got a great sense of humour, and he keeps things rolling along, and he's got a good brain, and he does Harry Hill scripts and all those kind of things. So, you know, he's fun. So I like those kind of shows. So you can have a bit of a laugh, and you can explain things to people or find out things about people. So... the show I used to do would be, how the hell did this newspaper piece appear here? Or how did they get this story? And those are the kind of things that people, they liked it.
Well, I mean,
and I'm more interested in that than just saying that so-and-so's got to be fired, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He's got to go. I mean, he's just got to go. I can only take one of those. I can't do that. I remember doing one with, when it used to be called Talk Radio, it just reminded me, I was doing it with Gary Newbon. God,
oh,
love
wow,
it.
Okay.
Newbon. And I just... It was one of those 4-hour phone-ins of, they're going to win tonight. I'll tell you, so why are they going to win tonight? Oh, I don't know. I just know they're going to win. And I just wanted to shoot myself in the face. I was thinking, there's three hours of this.
Oh, man.
So I'd like to do something, just something that's flipping entertaining.
Yeah.
Not pompous, not preachy. Just tell us something, have a laugh. Give me an anecdote. Give me something interesting so I can repeat to my mates, or something just to leave the flipping radio on. I just know they're going to win 3-0.
Well, as someone who used to work at 6:06, yeah. I can empathise with that. Oh, you know, writing articles, being in charge of newspapers, there's a different types of intensity compared to if the red light goes on in a radio studio or a TV studio? Did you find it natural?
No, I shit myself for the first time. No problem. You're meant to be nervous. Yeah. If you walk out into the middle of the pitch and at the end of the Champions League final, you are aware that you're in unusual territory. And
but I think it takes a skill, though, because
it takes fear, conquering fear, and then relaxing into it. The first time you do it, it's, what the hell am I doing? I'm in the pitch! Oh my God, I'm on the pitch! Why are we on the pitch? That's terrifying. There's that 10 million people watching whatever it is. But
of course.
The first time it's quite sphincter tightening, but you get used to it.
Because now I think it's quite normal to see pundits on the pitch. When you're watching football, Sky, BT, you know, whatever you're watching on Eurosport, it will be on, you know, there'll be three pundits on the sidelines, sometimes literally on the pitch.
Yeah.
But I think you were pretty much one of the first people to do it, though, and becoming quite a...
Going at the end. The pre-match is all calm. Post-match is chaos. I like the chaos, because it means it's not going to be the same old, our 3 points today, I'm very glad we got it. You want something that just... That's why I like doing it on the pitch, because you get the kind of buzz from fans, you can play off them, things go wrong. When things go wrong, it's actually, well, not technically wrong, but if somebody says something they shouldn't say, it's like swear on air and all that kind of stuff, that's all part of the colour, and it makes it more real, and I like those.
I watched a clip of you, I think it was after the Liverpool Champions League win, and you were on the pitch, and you had, I don't know if it's you or your producer, had collared Salah, Firmino, and
no producer says that.
No,
I don't get told that. I don't get told anything in my ear other than cue Des and wrap it up if you can.
All right,
and sometimes I ignore that as well. I don't get that.
They were celebrating.
Yeah,
let them go.
Yeah, the Liverpool. Well, yeah, there's this sort of it worked well on the night, for instance. So all I could you're facing me, and we're doing an interview. I know that the Liverpool players are running past us or about to. So I just let them go with him, and I said, we'll call them back. To be fair, I'd actually grabbed Jordan Henderson in the semi-final and we did an interview time, which I probably should have let him go and enjoy himself and come back. So I was conscious of that in the final. That's simple as that. It's just a bit of common sense. Gary Lineker picked it up and made it work, because he could have just been eating his sandwich while I'm doing the interviews, and suddenly I throw back to him. No, and he picked it up perfectly. It was great. And the director followed it on the spider cam. And so they all had to make that. I've said, right, I'm going to off you come back to us. Don't worry about this, because they were coming like the Red Arrows. And if those two had messed it up, I would have looked terrible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they were so sharp.
It made great television.
Yeah,
though.
Looked good.
Yeah, because it's such a big moment. And I think watching that again on YouTube, but watching it again, you still had the same sense that, as a viewer, you're in it so much more than if you're up in the gallery with
Gary.
And if
I'd stopped them when they all run past, in the background, they'd all be celebrating and I'd be talking to them, and you know they don't want to be there. So it's much more fun. They did come back, thankfully. If they hadn't come back, that would have been a disaster.
No, they did. But like you going onto the pitch at literally full time, was that your idea?
No, it's just the way it is. The first time I did it, I had to share it. Back in the UEFA Champions League days, you had to share a camera with three other different broadcasters from different countries. Oh, that's horrendous. You have to get pointy elbows there. I can remember some guy trying to pull the plug out of the camera because I was spending too long with Gareth Bale, that kind of nonsense. But, you know. It can be quite brutal. In the interview section, in the tunnel, for instance. All right, so we'll finish the pitch first. You walk out onto the pitch, if you feel like you're stepping on ice, you know, and it's going to come, you're going to fall straight through in the cracked ice. But that's exciting. In the tunnel, it's quite oppressive. So it's a little bit like a battery hen situation. So, but you're the host broadcaster, so I will usually get the first interview with all the anger, all the emotion, sometimes incomprehensible, sometimes good, sometimes really bad, you know, but it's there and you've got all the emotion. And if you're in the tunnel, there's people buzzing around and there's loads of other broadcasters in the Champions League, for instance, you know, so there'll be all the countries you'd expect, but they're further and further down the line. So when you start the interview, there's people pulling you, there's people poking, there's people trying to cut the interview off, all this kind of... So you have to... I couldn't quite get my head around it because my personality would be to tell people what to do, but you have to kind of... You have to do that, but you have to focus on what you're doing. You can't get involved in too many rows. I mean, I've had a few, some good ones.
Yeah. Oh, so were you only aware of that when you started working in TV?
I'd never done the tunnel routine, no.
So when you were haters, you weren't there?
Oh, no. When I went in first time, it was like all new to me. Not necessarily good either. You felt really exposed and on your own.
Yeah, because I suppose football's such a huge business these days. It's
Yes, and when you haven't been in that environment, you Colin Montgomery is a golfer, okay? I remember this. I was waiting to interview him at the Open, and I must be... from here to the house across the street, so 50 yards away, but let's say. And I'm waiting at a barrier here, leaning, waiting for him to finish his practice. And at the back of his swing, he just stopped and went, "I'll be 20 minutes. And I was thinking, how did he even notice me? So that was part of his thing. He noticed everything around him. I kind of do the same thing. I'm always seeing people, faces and thinking, trying to read the room. You can't do that in that interview. You literally have to stop it like blinkers on and just don't get involved with this guy. We're in Italy. Manchester City were away, so I'll narrow it down that much. So, and a Kyle Walker had to go in goal because keeper got sent off. So I get into the flash position. Kyle's good fan. I like him. I can't remember who's alongside him. I've had two people on the boards and we're chatting away. And the UEFA guy says, "No, you can't start. You can't start. You can only have one player." I said, "No." He said, "We can do one after the other." I said, "No, that takes double the time. We'll do two." And these Italians pull me off the microphone and out. So I then have a little altercation, like Harry Kane last night, hand to the face. And anyway, as that happens, they go, "Right, Des, cue Des." I don't know. I'm still struggling. And Kyle Walker's face is open mouthed as we start. So right now, he's got a face on. It's just for a couple of seconds. It's a bit of a bundle sometimes. It does get a little bit aggressive, but not often. But there is always something around that changes things. There's noises and people crashing in and out and pulling you. And there's always that. And Champions League final, City-Chelsea one, that was carnage. That was at the end because it was sort of COVID, but it wasn't. And everyone was climbing on top of everybody else. And it was mayhem. Brilliant. Yeah. But I had very little control over what was being said or done. It was just chaos. And it was kind of fun, but... It's a bit stressful.
Yeah, I can imagine. It must be stressful. You're there when, you know, you're talking to these players. Some are media managed, some aren't as much.
Yeah.
And you kind of, you're there right at the heart of it. But you have to frame it in a way which is, you know, 7, 8 o'clock at night for UK viewers. Family might be watching.
And yeah, I always do the Ofcom. We're sorry about the language thing. It's a bit late now. It's not 8 o'clock actually. It's the true sort of ruling is that the expected audience. So if kids don't go to bed at 8 o'clock when the Champions League's on, they go on to 8, 10:30. So you have to be aware of that. That's the audience. It's just the available audience or the likely audience. But oh yeah, the swearing and but I like all that. See, people don't know the things that happened. Like at that final, we weren't allowed to use the same microphone because of post-COVID, blah, blah, blah. And of course, the players would walk away from the actual microphone they're meant to be using. So you're talking, they're not talking, or I'm not talking because I've got just chaos. But I think the chaos is what people like.
Well, I definitely think in the age of, you know, social media and, you know, transparency, that kind of, let's say, authenticity is probably more entertaining because people understand that it's not. You know, you are real people working in a real harsh environment, especially in sport as well, with such a circus that follows it sometimes.
Everyone comes in with the blood still pumping. Mm-hmm. And it's like you can see it. It's anger, celebration. And to capture that, it's pretty much the job.
Do you think when you look at your career now, and you look at your that sounds like I'm going to say something terrible, but I'm not, I promise. Do you pinch yourself? Because
yeah,
a lot of people would would say that you have their dream job. I mean, you get to not only watch football, you're on the pitch.
All of them have been dream jobs. I've had some amazing experiences. For Formula One, I've had some amazing experiences. And
Formula One?
Well, covering it and then getting involved in it. And so I was in the world's first Formula One double-seater. So I was with Alonso. And those kind of things come along, that you get an opportunity to do something and you just, wow, really? Okay. You know, like I said, if you get an opportunity, the policy pretty much is, I'll try and do that.
Could you strike me as someone that is still very much enjoying your job, the fact that you work in sport, you seem to take it in a good humour and understand.
I can be right grumpy if it's going wrong. Honestly, you can ask the crew. I can be crouchy in a bad way, grouchy. But no, I don't take myself too seriously. This sounds ridiculous because I'm talking about my career with you for an hour. I don't overthink it. I want to do it well. I like the control that I have to do it the way I like to do it. If somebody said you can't do that, I probably wouldn't be enjoying it so much. But I think it just feels like it works. So try and keep it that way. Dream job, yeah. But I've always felt I had a dream job. If I was in charge of the Daily Mirror sports sections, it's like, wow, okay, this is great. It always felt that way. And I've never taken it for granted. I've never done anything but appreciate the opportunities I have. And I'm very conscious I've been a very lucky boy.
Is there anything you want to do that you haven't done?
That's a good question. No is not the right answer, because obviously I want to do something else. But I don't feel I've missed out on anything. If I've had a radio show, I've had a telly show, 136 episodes of random sort of mayhem. Some of the funniest things were in the early days of BT Sport. We did things. So I interviewed Harry Redknapp on stage, but through a door, because he always was interviewed. So we built a Skoda wind car into his chair and he had to wait. Bear in mind, there's a live audience there. He had to wait till I wound the window down before we allowed him to talk. And then we started. And the other, what was the other one? The other one was, well, there was many. There were many. But the other one I remember was we got Emil Heskey in. Rachel Riley was there. There's a panel at the top anyway. And it was the fact that he couldn't score. So this phrase was, you couldn't hit a cow's ass with a banjo. So obviously we dressed up one of the interns as a cow, full with udders, then got a banjo, put him in front of the stage and challenged Heskey to hit the cow with the banjo. He said, what, really? I said, don't worry, he's on the minimum wage, it doesn't matter. That had me, they dragged me into human HR department to tell me off about that. Anyway, it was live as well.
Yeah.
And to hit didn't break. So I said, no, hit him harder, which brought me another HR complaint. And he hit, and the top of the banjo flew through the air past Rachel Riley's head. Yeah. Can you imagine what that would have... That got something like 500,000 views at the time. And it was... I think Jimmy Kimmel was only ahead of us in the YouTube stakes. But it's probably been taken off now because it was a little bit one of those days where it could have gone wrong, but God, it was funny.
Oh, wow, yeah.
So we had some great time at the start. And then when you get into the... But that was a sort of sideshow. And then to be put into the main event, it's a great privilege.
What's the thing you're most proud of in terms of what's the best thing you've produced, do you think? Whoa. Does anything stand out?
No, they're all equally bad. It's a bit too navel-gazy. I can't talk about anything with BT because there's loads of things I like about that and some that I don't, but there are loads of things that I'm really proud of. Winning the Columnist Award early-ish days in my career, that was a big boost for me, and I was very proud of that because the other contenders were Michael Parkinson, Hugh McIlvenny, James Lawton, who's a legend, and Patrick Collins. So they're all big guns, and I was glad to... That was a good night. I celebrated. I was actually taken the award home. It was like the size of this sort of iPad Pro thing. It was a certificate, and it had a big golden frame around it. And I'm quite three sheets to the wind, shall we say. And I've got my certificate framed in my jacket. It was cold. I was walking down to Leicester Square Station, And this bloke got a knife out and said, give me that. And I went, what? I said, give me the award. No, he didn't know it was an award, sorry. Give me what you've got in your coat. So I gave it to him and I said, it's my certificate. He went, oh, no, here you go, you can have it back. It wasn't even good enough to mug, but I'm very proud of it.
Des Kelly and how he became something in media. How did Des carve out such an amazing career? We'll get further insights from our in-house careers advisor via our website at somethingin.media, where you can glean a deeper understanding of what it takes to make it in the media and even an opportunity to book a one-on-one session. You'll also find a newsletter sign up via our website. Something In Media is a Stable production. And if you enjoyed listening, please follow us by pressing the subscribe button wherever you get your podcasts. And if you think somebody may benefit by listening to these types of stories, please do let them know where to find us.